ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Alan Kohler, and I want to take you straight to the source. Every Friday, I sit down with the people running companies, shaping industries, and influencing the Australian economy to talk risk, power, profit, pressure, not just their success, but their strategy, and what it means for the rest of us. Because that's business. Search, subscribe, and stay ahead. Find That's Business with Alan Kohler on the ABC Business Daily feed, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcast.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. Have you bumped into any journalists at your local petrol station recently?
I'm here at a petrol station in Sydney's inner city.
At North Ryde, no ride. The billboard's blank, the taps are off.
I just want to give you a shot at this Shell servo. When we came onto air early this morning, it was roughly around 2.30 a litre for unleaded. It's now gone up to 2.50, 2.54. Wow.
Covering an energy crisis is tricky. There's no explosions or protests, just vaguely distraught motorists furrowing their brows at unpleasant roadside signs.
Then I looked up next minute, it was $90 in there, and I thought, fuck it, me.
Bloody oath, driving around all day, it's hard.
I'm really hoping something gives soon.
For people younger than, like, 60, this feels unprecedented. Something happening far, far away on the other side of the world has caused the price of diesel to almost double in a few weeks and has sparked concerns that we might run out of it.
There are currently 38 days worth of petrol and 30 days of diesel and jet fuel in the national reserves.
The thing is, this isn't unprecedented.
It is something that has happened before.
The shocks we saw in the 1970s.
In the 1970s, oil prices skyrocketed, triggering a global economic crisis. And what caused those oil shocks back then?
Supply shortages and price spikes caused by conflict in the Middle East.
Ah, yes. All very familiar. But I think there's something fascinating in comparing the oil shocks of the 70s with what we're all living through right now. See, after those massive economic crises in the 70s, the United States spent enormous time and resources trying to stop something like that from ever happening again. And yet, here we are. So what went wrong? Why did the schemes cooked up after the last lot of oil shocks fail this time? And what do they tell us about what's going to happen next? I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. While we've been making the last few episodes, I've been working on an overarching theory about what's going on here. Why the US joined Israel's attack on Iran, despite the obvious risks to its allies in the Persian Gulf and to the global economy. And here's what I've got. Since the end of World War II, the United States has been trying to balance two primary interests in the Middle East.
Our number one commitment in the Middle East is to protect the right of Israel to exist permanently, and to exist in peace.
So that's interest number one. The other one is this.
The unimpeded flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz is a vital US interest. It's critical to the economic health of the Western world.
Okay, so protect Israel and keep the oil flowing out of the Strait of Hormuz. Israel and oil. Of course, there are other interests in the region, but when it comes to long-term objectives, which justify the enormous amount of money the US spends in the Gulf, it's primarily these two. Their involvement with Israel starts at the very beginning with President Harry Truman.
I also antagonized a lot of people by recognizing the State of Israel as soon as it was formed.
This is from an account he gave after he left the White House about why he supported Israel so quickly.
And I'd seen some of the places where the Jews had been slaughtered by the Nazis. 6 million Jews were killed outright, men, women, and children, by the Nazis. And it was my hope that they would have a homeland where they could operate.
So he got to work.
I had to make a compromise with the Arabs and divide Palestine. The Jews wanted to chase all the Arabs into the Tigris and Euphrates River, and the Arabs wanted to chase all the Jews into the Red Sea. And what I was trying to do was to find a homeland for the Jews and still be just with the Arabs.
Did he figure out a solution for that? Well, not really. But anyway,
something had to be done. We went ahead and done it, and had it done, and now it's working out. Eventually, I think we'll have them all satisfied.
Sure, sounds great. Israel's off and running then. So what about the oil? Well, let's head to Iran in 1953.
The CIA's first success in bringing down a government came in Iran.
In the early 1950s, the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, nationalized the country's oil industry.
At that time, Iran's oil belonged to the British and a consortium of other foreign countries.
The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, now BP, was taken over by the government, which planned to use its profits to benefit the people of Iran.
The Americans, fearing that Iran's huge oil reserves would fall into Soviet hands, agreed to get rid of Mossadegh.
The CIA, under the control of a man with the ridiculous name of Kermit Roosevelt, wrote a letter ordering the dismissal of Prime Minister Mossadegh and gave it to the Shah of Iran to sign. When protests broke out against the Shah's decision, the Shah's army arrested the demonstrators. Then the CIA agents went to work, literally paying people to protest in favour of the Shah.
Liberal use of dollar bills and Persian rial notes secured a mob which shouted support for the Shah. It was the CIA's first and most successful coup.
Mossadegh was arrested, and the Shah abolished democratic control of Iran.
The Shah never really shook off the image that he was a tool of the West.
The Shah wasn't the only oil-rich king that the US had a relationship with. They were also buddying up to the King of Saudi Arabia, building an oil alliance through the Arab American Oil Company, or Aramco. So, Israel's chugging along, and the oil is flowing. Both interests are balanced. Well, sort of.
The Middle East and Arabs and Israelis at war with each other for the fourth time in 25 years.
25 years on from the establishment of Israel, there was still some dissatisfaction. But until 1973, Israel was never at risk of actually losing one of these wars.
On Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, Egypt sends its Soviet-equipped troops slashing into Israel.
This time it's been different. The Arabs' new SAM missiles, provided by the Russians, have added a new factor to the air war.
For the first time in 25 years of conflict with Arabs, the Israelis tasted defeat.
The Israelis were seriously concerned that they were going to run out of firepower. They called the Americans for help. It was 1973, and the Americans were kind of in a panic of their own. President Richard Nixon was deep in the weeds of the Watergate scandal and was spending most of his time trying to save his own presidency. The increasingly panicked phone calls from Israel were taken by the newly sworn-in Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger.
The United States has a traditional friendship with Israel, which it will maintain.
The Israelis were asking him to resupply their weapons before their stockpiles ran out. Kissinger recalled there was hesitancy from the US military. They were concerned that resupplying Israel with weapons would undermine America's relationship with oil-supplying Arab states like Saudi Arabia.
The Defense Department was geared to the Saudi relationship, and they did not want to produce a situation of crisis.
The situation was tricky. The Nixon administration's economic policies already had caused occasional minor domestic fuel shortages, and prices were on the way up. Meanwhile, the King of Saudi Arabia had warned that he would cut off oil supply to the US if Nixon supported Israel in the war, threatening to use what he described as an oil weapon.
The Arabs had produced a weapon few thought they would ever use.
Henry Kissinger faced a choice: keep Israel alive or keep the oil flowing. He took the issue to Nixon.
And I said, I will not let Israel go down the tube.
American planes began arriving in Israel to resupply them with weapons. Israel survived. But what about the oil?
OPEC, the Organization of Oil Producing States, announced that oil production would be cut by 5% every month until Israel withdrew behind its 1967 borders.
They fired their oil weapon.
I think we can cut down production to, let's say, 20%. You think Europe or Japan or the United States can survive with this?
With a shock, the industrial nations realized just how vulnerable their dependence on oil had made them.
So that was the 1973 oil crisis. Just a few years later, there was another one involving America's old mate, the Shah of Iran.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world.
Turns out that overthrowing a democratically elected government and propping up a puppet king isn't a foolproof way to ensure lasting oil supply.
The Shah in exile, his mighty army beaten in the streets, his secret service purged, his oil wells shut down.
This wasn't a deliberate use of an oil weapon. It was a US-backed regime collapsing into chaos.
Shipments stopped leaving Iran 6 weeks ago. 10% of the non-communist world's oil.
What emerged from the Islamic Revolution of 1979 in Iran was a regime which built a big part of its identity around the simple chant, "Death to Israel, death to America." Before long, the Arabs and Iranians were in a full-blown war, a conflict that disrupted oil supply for a decade. The balancing act had failed, and the results were extraordinary. In terms of those results, it's hard to know where to start, but let's just start in the United States.
To be sure that there is enough oil to go around for the entire winter, all over the country, it will be essential for all of us to live and work in lower temperatures.
President Nixon asked everyone in the country to set their heating thermostats to 68 degrees Fahrenheit, or 20 degrees Celsius.
Incidentally, my doctor tells me that in a temperature of 66 to 68 degrees, you're really more healthy than when it's 75 to 78, if that's any comfort.
Air travel was also curtailed by 10%. Businesses were encouraged to decrease their operating hours. Nixon also signed a law pushing the entire country into daylight saving time in the middle of winter, in an effort to conserve energy in the evenings by shifting the sunset a bit later. Other laws were passed to encourage people to drive less.
On the New York State Thruway, the signs are going up as fast as they can be printed. No gasoline from 9 p.m. Saturday to midnight Sunday.
New York City police officers were so low on fuel, they could only use their cars in emergencies.
We're leaving our cars and patrolling on foot.
Other motorists decided to ride bicycles instead.
Why do you ride that bicycle?
On account of the gas shortage, cannot get gas, so I decided to go by bicycle. It's a whole lot cheaper than gas.
People even decided against putting up Christmas lights that year to save energy.
Usually I take my kids out to see all the lights, and this year there were hardly any lights out to see.
The US had domestic oil supplies, though, so could blunt the worst effects of this crisis. Other countries weren't so lucky.
This is going to be a very bleak winter for the British. Motorists have been asked to keep to a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit and not to drive on Sundays if they can avoid doing so.
As prices rose, petrol stations started running out of fuel, because so many people were doing exactly what they always do at times like this.
Panic buying of gasoline by motorists has worsened the situation. Many filling stations have sold out.
The high price of fuel flowed into high prices for everything else.
Bread, fruit, vegetables, eggs, fish and meat all went up in price.
In continental Europe, fuel shortages drove some people to convert their cars to wind and pedal power. In India, the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi started travelling around in a horse-drawn carriage. In Australia, petrol was rationed based on whether your number plate ended in an odd or even number.
Officially, today was for the even numbers, but this didn't deter a high number of drivers with odd-numbered plates sitting through the long, hot queues.
Petrol station queues were common all across the world. There was some debate among the people in the queues about what the cause was.
I think it's just a symptom of a disease called capitalism.
The situation is caused by people using their credit cards
There were lots of reasons for it, I suppose, but from a foreign policy perspective, there was one main cause. In both 1973 and 1979, the global economy paid the price for botched American intervention in Middle East politics, trying and failing to balance their interests in Israeli security and oil production. The oil crises of the 1970s were incredibly disruptive and chaotic. Each night, reporters in petrol station parking lots right across the country spoke about the pain they were causing everyday people. Just like today, only with bigger mustaches. Because they didn't just mean queues at petrol stations. They also contributed to massive inflation. As we discussed in our Black Swans episode about transport, the 1970s oil shocks caused a seismic shift in global energy and transportation policy, and have had huge implications for US foreign policy. Ever since, the US has been far more careful in their efforts to balance these two key interests in the Middle East without triggering another crisis. They've been building strong relationships with Arab states in an effort to disarm the oil weapon. They've tried to foster peace agreements between Israelis and Palestinians.
Of a comprehensive peace settlement for the Middle East.
Ladies and gentlemen, the time for peace has come.
We mark the dawn of a new Middle East.
At times, the US has resorted to military action to try and stabilize the region. But before taking those steps, US presidents weighed the risks. Would it jeopardize Israeli security or oil supply? If the answer to either of those questions was yes, then they generally wouldn't do it. Meanwhile, the US has been trying to make itself immune from oil shocks by developing domestic oil supply. Though, as we discussed in our last episode,
the world oil market is one market, and should Persian Gulf oil supplies be disrupted, the oil prices will rise for everyone.
For years, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has pushed the US to prioritize Israeli security over oil.
I think it's the height of folly. It's the quest for peace at any price.
But US presidents, from Clinton all the way to Biden, have resisted. It's Israel's right, of course, to lobby the US government.
We must all stand together to stop Iran's march of conquest, subjugation, and terror.
The US government just isn't obliged to listen to them. But finally, a US president did listen and followed Israel into a war that was obviously going to interrupt oil supply without doing anything to prepare the global economy for the impacts. I don't know whether Donald Trump just didn't understand the delicate balance that every president for decades has been maintaining, or if he didn't care. But he picked a side, like Nixon and Truman. It's worth remembering that when Nixon made that choice, Israel was facing an immediate existential threat. That was not the case for Trump. He didn't grasp that the choice wasn't, should I bomb Iran or not? But was actually, should I do what Bibi Netanyahu wants, or do I want oil to stay under $100 a barrel? The balancing act has failed once again. I don't know how much like the 70s this is going to get. I'm just hoping that I don't have to get into disco. If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. Supervising producer is Kara Jensen-McKinnon. It's produced by Adair Shepherd and Pat Sunderland. Audio production this week is by Anna John. On Tuesday, we're going to take a look at an extraordinary moment in history, a time when an incredibly diverse group of people from all over the world, from South African anti-apartheid activists to Cuban revolutionaries and Russian spies, built a community in a place you'd never expect. It's a cracker of a story. You're going to love it. I'll catch you on Tuesday.